ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Although in recent years the rise of online news outlets such as The Guardian, Crikey, The New Daily, The Saturday Paper and the like has widened the sort of news sources that Australians can access, as well as broadening media ownership here, our media is still, of course, very concentrated in a very few hands. In particular, the Murdoch companies have a very strong hold on what Australians read and see, particularly in daily newspapers. Of course, he's also a huge presence in Western media worldwide. So how did this media concentration happen, and what was it about post-war Australia which meant conditions were ripe for media barons to rise and rise, concentrating power and wielding great political influence and making huge fortunes in a way that it didn't really happen in other parts of the world? Well, Sally Young, Professor of Political Science at the University of Melbourne, is with us now to elucidate with her latest study of Australian media, focusing on how the Australian newspaper industry of the 1940s right through to the 70s were uniquely wealthy and powerful, controlled by ruthless men with close links to politics, power and money. Sound familiar? Who, in Rupert Murdoch's case, went on to export elements of this media culture worldwide, particularly starting in the United Kingdom, but then to the US with the Fox Network. And need we say more? Anyway, joining us tonight is Sally Young. Sally, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Thank you.
This all sounds, when you read it, like it could be the plot for another series of Succession. Perhaps it's the prequels to it in a way, but this is a big task to try and track the rise of Australia's media empires. What was the media situation like in Australia back in 1941? How many newspapers were there? The Bulletin magazine was still influential. What was ownership like then? And it was certainly more diverse than now, wasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely was more diverse. It was already consolidated. After the 1920s, we lost quite a few metropolitan newspapers after the Depression. But there were more, certainly, than we had in later years. And we had more owners too, and some really colourful characters who were controlling metropolitan newspapers at the time. So in each city, most of them had at least two newspapers left, an afternoon and a morning usually, and some cities had three or four even in Sydney. So we had some competition between
So the big cities, what, Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, Perth, all had morning and afternoon newspapers, did they?
Yeah, that's right. So, for example, Melbourne had the Argus and the Age, Sun News Pictorial, and then it had an afternoon paper, the Herald. Mm-hmm. And in Sydney, where there was quite intense competition even in later times, they had two morning papers and two afternoon papers competing against each other.
Right. Okay. You describe how the paper emperors, as you called them, worked together to bring down Menzies' first government. This is the one when in 1939. Why did they want that result anyway?
The major newspaper owners, particularly Warwick Fairfax, were not getting along with Menzies, thought he wasn't doing a very good job during the wartime period. They were particularly annoyed with him because of newsprint rationing, which had really impacted on their sales and their capacity to put out newspapers. So in Sydney, Frank Packer and Warwick Fairfax were sort of united at this point in being displeased with Menzies. And in Melbourne, Keith Murdoch as well had some run-ins with Menzies and found that Menzies wasn't easily controlled on certain matters that Keith Murdoch would have liked to have had more influence with. So there was that, but there was also broader issues in terms of Menzies in the Liberal Party and his colleagues as well. So he was considered quite arrogant and not listening to either colleagues or powerful newspaper barons.
Yeah, that's true. Just sketch, can you briefly, who the barons were at this period we're talking about, the beginning of the Second World War? There's Murdoch in Keith Murdoch in Melbourne. And then who have we got in Sydney?
So we've got Frank Packer,
yep,
of the Daily Telegraph, owning the Daily Telegraph, and we've got the Fairfax family, Warwick Fairfax, in charge of the Sydney Morning Herald. In Sydney, there's also Ezra Norton, who was a very colourful character and media owner.
Liar and a ratbag, but anyway.
Yes. But compared to his father, a good bloke, I think. his father was even worse. But also in Sydney, there was the Sun newspaper, and Hugh Dennison was one of the founders of that, but he'd just recently died at the start of World War II. So It's more being run by some elderly gentlemen committees there.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the sort of four competing papers in Sydney. And as you said, in Melbourne, we had Keith Murdoch, who didn't own the Herald and Weekly Times papers, but was in charge of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his own newspaper interests in Queensland. So he had the Courier Mail, which he secretly owned with John Wren, the infamous Melbourne
gangster. Oh, is that right?
Gangster.
Okay. Mm. Yeah.
So they co-owned that paper for quite a while, didn't like each other, didn't get along, didn't talk to each other much, but were in business together with that paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Adelaide, we had the powerful Advertiser, which the Herald and Weekly Times was involved with. And we also had the News, which many people think Keith Murdoch started, but he didn't. It had been started in the 20s. But, of course, he gets a hold of it through the Herald and Weekly Times and later gets a personal stake in it.
This is the famous one, of course, that he leaves to Rupert, isn't it? And Rupert's
exactly.
And that's the little paper that Rupert starts his empire with.
Exactly. That's the paper.
Right.
And Rupert felt he'd been robbed of the Courier Mail because that was a paper that Keith Murdoch, as I said, had a ownership in as well.
Right.
So
what was going on in Perth?
In Perth, there were two papers. So we had the West Australian, the morning paper, and we had the Daily News, the afternoon tabloid.
Mm-hmm.
So they were owned by a company which Murdoch had been involved with in the 20s on behalf of Collins House mining magnates, particularly the Bayou family. But they'd got out of that, or so it had appeared. So that paper was, representing sort of Perth's interests or the mining company interests there. So those were the two papers in Perth. And then in Hobart we had the Mercury, and in Canberra the Canberra Times, which had struggled through the Depression years and managed to survive with a very small population there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who owned those papers there?
So in Hobart with the Mercury, the yeah. Davies brothers, the
right.
Limited.
So they were independent in the sense of that.
Yeah, that's right. At this time in the 40s, they still are.
Yeah.
And the Canberra Times was owned by Federal Capital Press, which was the Shakespeare family. So
okay. Again, not part of any empire
no,
at this stage.
Not yet.
Exactly. You call the World War II period a golden age for newspapers. Why? Why was it so special?
Well, they were still the main media game in town. I mean, they had radio to compete against and magazines, which now had sort of glossy, colourful covers and pages that were a bit more competition to papers. But basically, papers were the powerful news and information medium, and they still held a great deal of power and wealth. The ones that had survived and now had consolidated their position in these media markets were doing well. Mostly, especially in Sydney and Melbourne. Some of them were making a great deal of money, like the Sydney Morning Herald, for example, out of its classifieds. So they were powerful, they were wealthy, they had influence, and they had credibility, and people relied upon them for news. They were eagerly awaiting newspapers in the morning and getting more newspapers in the afternoon, and they were the breaking news medium of the day. So circulation was good, especially the war. Elevated circulation, people buy more newspapers to read about dramatic wartime events. So they had a lot of things going for them at this time. They seem to be on top of the world, really. They're struggling a little bit in terms of grappling with how to compete with radio, but they'd come up with a sort of solution for that, which was get radio licenses in the cities they were in. So many of them were in the radio space. Particularly the ones that were about to do well. So it was a golden era where they're not as challenged as they are by media in later years.
No, exactly. That's right. What appeared in the paper actually mattered at the time. The governments knew this too, didn't they? The Chifley government in power until 1949, what was its attitude to the press anyway? Governments usually hate newspapers, did they?
They don't all hate newspapers. Sometimes they have quite a close and cooperative relationship with some newspapers, particularly on the liberal side of politics, because often these newspaper owners were very anti-socialist, anti-labor. A lot of the papers always advocated a vote for the Conservative parties. So sometimes governments get along well with newspapers, but the Chifley government, its major point of combat for newspapers was that it was considering bringing in television to Australia, but bringing in a public broadcasting only model. So having a public broadcaster and no commercial television stations, and this was a big concern for the newspapers here, because if there was going to be television brought into Australia, they wanted a slice of it. So like the American model, where they could run television stations and get all the commercial advertising for that. So that was one difficult point for them about the Chifley government and Arthur Corwell, the Labor MP.
I love this.
Corwell was actually,
that's right, he became, listen to this for a kind of Brave New World sort of title, he was Minister for Information. Serving from exactly. 1943 to 1949. He took his job seriously, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he was the newspaper owner's worst enemy, really. So he'd already had a lot to say about commercial newspapers and, you know, he made sure that he was a thorn in their side, really. So he was determined, for example, that they don't get into commercial television. He was, adamant that that shouldn't be a commercial medium. And he also kept a tight rein on them with censorship restrictions as well. So he had some famous battles with the press.
Yes, 2 years before he was sworn in as minister. This is Corwell. Corwell had famously said the Australian press, quote, is owned by, for the most part by financial crooks and edited for the most part by mental harlots. So he had a balanced view of proceedings.
He didn't mince words. He was very verbally combative and he didn't bother to hide his contempt for the newspaper owners. He despised Keith Murdoch, for example, and made sure that everybody knew it.
There's a great picture in the book, actually, of a point at which I think it was Corwell who ordered this, that newspapers be prevented from being distributed at one point. And there's a picture of a constable with a gun. It's a gun drawn. You don't see that much in Australia,
particularly
for something like a newspaper distribution. But the constable's got the gun drawn saying, you will not distribute this newspaper. What was going on there?
So this was when newspapers were, in Corwell's mind, breaking censorship restrictions, and the chief censor had warned newspapers not to talk about how they were being censored. That was part of the censorship rules. And the newspapers were getting a bit sick of this and a bit sick of Corwell. So the major Sydney owners banded together and decided they would print some blank spaces to show where they'd been, copy had been censored and taken out of the paper. That was not on. So the chief censor recommended that they be rounded up and, not distributed these newspapers. So on this day, Corwell had said that he would back the chief censor in this move. So Commonwealth Police arrived at newspaper offices and took away newspapers, stopped the printing presses, and then it ended up in the High Court.
What happened?
Well, the newspaper owners put out that they had won, but in some sense they had. I mean, they'd managed to stop the government from restricting them from delivering newspapers. And the censorship rules were made more clear that censorship couldn't be for moral reasons or morale reasons. So it had to be about wartime activities, which was something that they wanted. So in one sense, it certainly looked like they had won. And they made that very clear because, of course, they own the newspapers, so they can put out this perspective. But on the other hand, they didn't quite get rid of Corwell. They still had to deal with him for some time yet. But censorship was reined in a bit from that point, so the chief censor acted a bit more cautiously after that.
It was. It's been interesting looking back because you see the roots of much of what we reap today, or the harvest we reap today, was sown back then. And the book also sets out the formation in May 1943. This is 80 years ago, of a group of leading Melbourne businessmen, including Keith Murdoch, had established an institute called the Institute of Public Affairs, the IPA, which, of course, is still there. What was all that about, and what were they trying to influence?
Well, they were trying to influence the Labor government at the time, which was trying to extend sort of wartime restrictions in a way that the business owners found very unpalatable. So they wanted to reap the benefit of this sort of pent-up demand for goods and services that had been going on during the war. Mm-hmm. And the government looked like it was still going to impose restrictions on things. And so they were very frustrated that they weren't getting anywhere with this government, and Keith Murdoch in particular, because in the past he'd really had the ear of people in power, say Joe Lyons when he was Prime Minister. So they found the Labor government wasn't listening to business and that this was their way of trying to make sure that they were heard and to try and bring down that government, in fact. So
it was a real meeting of influential capitalists, wasn't it? The first chairman was George Coles, who was the, you know, from the Coles family, of course. There were whole lots of them there. Harold Darling, chairman of BHP, was also in it. Chairman of David Jones, as well as CSR, Woolworths, and so on. It was quite a heavy-hitting bunch, wasn't it?
Yes, they certainly weren't mucking around. I mean, they saw the government's activities at the time as really an impost on business, and that they wanted to make it clear that they weren't going to put up with this. So they get this group together, and Keith Murdoch, of course, is on the publicity/propaganda arm here, and they get a lot of money and a big war chest come in from all these major companies to fight what, a government that they considered to be a very socialist government that was harming big business. So they've geared up to fight against it, and they use a lot of campaigning techniques. The banks are involved as well, so it was all the major players. And this is where we're getting to the lead up to the 1949 election to fight against the Labor government and see it out of office.
So it's not really an Institute of Public Affairs, it's an Institute of Corporate Affairs, and in particular some corporates' affairs.
Yeah, that's a good way of summing it up, yes. But of course, this is not what they said. They said this is about helping Australia recover from the war, and you know, they're not really acknowledging that it's a fairly self-interested group here that's trying to achieve something you know, for corporate Australia, really.
What's good for business is good for Australia, in other words.
Exactly. And they were a big help to Menzies, of course, because they're doing policy research and giving him ideas as he's trying to start a new political party, which became the Liberal Party. So this is feeding him lots of material and ideas.
This is Nightlife. Philip Clark with you. We're speaking with Sally Young, Professor of Political Science at the University of Melbourne, who's written a book, well, she's been writing extensively about Australia's media industry. This one, Media Monsters, looks at the newspapers from the 1940s through to the 1970s. In 1949, of course, Menzies gets elected Prime Minister again. This is his great political triumph. I mean, there aren't many of these. People have managed to become Prime Minister twice. In this instance, Menzies gets elected Prime Minister again from a completely different political party, this one that he's formed himself. And so begins the Liberals' 23-year term as Australia's ruling party, led for 17 of those years by Robert Menzies himself. What was the attitude and regulation of the media during these decades? Or did Menzies enjoy, as you've suggested, a pretty good run with the media moguls as they were?
Well, he'd learned a lot from his first stint in office, where he considered them responsible for seeing him out of office that first time around. So in the intervening years, he's done a lot of work to get in the good books of newspaper owners.
So they've come around, have they?
Well, some of them are not convinced that he has the public popularity to become Prime Minister again, and Keith Murdoch was in that camp, but Menzies shows them that he does, and he gets their support. In fact, to the extent, as I say in the book, that when he was forming the Liberal Party, there was a dinner party in Melbourne where the major media owners came, which was, you know, from people like representing the Fairfaxes, the Packers, and Keith Murdoch as well, where they basically give their blessing to this new party and agree that they'll promote it as much as they can. So that's not really in the Liberal Party's brochures or information about the founding of their party, but that was an important meeting where the newspaper baron said, yes, we can work with Menzies, and the Labor government's so bad that's what they think at the time. We think it's so bad that we're willing to go back to Menzies and promote the Liberal Party, and that's what they do.
Let's talk a bit more about the dynasties. We've talked about a bit about Murdoch, of course. But the Packers, I mean, Frank Packer, most people might be surprised to know this, lived until 1974, although Kerry, his son, was learning the ropes of Consolidated Press and the Nine Network. How big was Packer's Consolidated Press through to the early 70s, and during the period we're talking about, from the 40s to the 70s?
Well, they're their big area of impact was television. Yeah. So television was something that Frank Packer had a natural sort of affinity to, sort of tabloid newspapers that are very popular, entertainment-based. You know, he transformed that, and cheaply run, which was always a key to how the Packers ran their empire. He translated that to television, and he got in first with the first regular television broadcasts and Channel 9 in Sydney. And he uses this model of buying in cheap American content, lots of Westerns, which he really liked as well, cheap content, and really makes the most of the opportunity in television. So in television, they were big. In newspapers, they had the Daily Telegraph in Sydney, but it was their only metropolitan newspaper. So they were small, dwarfed in newspapers by a company like the Herald and Weekly Times, which had several distributed across Australia. So in newspapers, they never really could beat the big players. They didn't have the money from the Rivers of Gold classified advertising that the Sydney Morning Herald did, and they didn't have the nation sort of wide reach that the Herald and Weekly Times did with lots of newspaper titles. But because Frank Packer was such a larger-than-life, domineering sort of personality and pretty ruthless in business matters, they always had to sort of take account of what he was doing or saying.
Mm. Yes, it's funny to think now, but of course, back in the day, these days, of course, if you wanted to advertise as a business or even as a person, you know, there's no internet, there's nothing online, and there are very few, apart from employing a sign writer or a printer to distribute pamphlets. If you want to reach a mass audience, newspapers are the way to do it, aren't they? So there are kind of a captive market, in a sense, they had, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely, especially with things like classifieds, which we forget now how important that was. You know, if you wanted a job, if you wanted to sell your car, if you wanted to advertise that you're getting married or you wanted to put a funeral notice in. Yeah, so, yeah, there were so many areas of life where you had to put in a classifieds ad or look at a classifieds ad. So a lot of people were buying newspapers probably for those ads. And I know that, you know, journalists would sometimes say that they'd get a paper, get a story in the paper, and they would go and watch as the papers come off the printing press and people buy them. And sometimes people pick up the paper, pull out the classified section and throw away the rest of the paper. You know, they were really important, those ads, not only for that reason, but financially for the newspapers as well.
Where do the Fairfaxes sit here in terms of the Murdochs and the Packers?
So they had this paper that had an enormous amount of classified advertising. It and The Age, particularly Sydney Morning Herald, had such a large share of those classified ads that it was just a lot of money coming into their organisation that they used to extend and buy other media assets and even non-media assets. But they were really, at this period of the book, when I'm looking at in the 1940s and 50s, they're really on an expansionist path. They'd mostly just focused on the Sydney Morning Herald, but now they've got this money coming in and they're using it to advance into things like radio and then television, also magazines. So they were also a very important family in Australian media history, a very important family. But they took a look, they had an interesting sort of public service element to what they were doing. You know, Frank Packer was quite blatantly, he would say, this is about money, and he was very concerned about profits and saving money and sacking journalists and lowering costs. But the Fairfaxes always had a sort of public interest element to what they were doing, which is quite interesting. They were very conservative, politically conservative, but they were had opportunities, for example, to buy other papers and shut them down. And sometimes they would balk at doing things like that and not do them because they were concerned that the Australian community have access to information. So they had a different sort of attitude. Their papers were run by someone called Rupert Henderson, who was the sort of business brain. So the Fairfax family were the sort of up the top and had a great interest in these things to a certain extent. But the day-to-day hard job of running a paper, Rupert Henderson tended to take on all of those sort of duties. And he was a sort of very ruthless character as well, but very well respected in the newspaper industry.
Yeah. And talk for a bit about Jack Williams, because most people mightn't have heard of him, but he was the unsung empire builder of the Herald and Weekly Times, wasn't he?
Yeah, so he was originally Keith Murdoch's protege. He was considered a sort of financial genius, was how he was actually described. So he helped Keith Murdoch set up some of the possibilities that that allowed him to move into owning his own newspapers, the Murdoch that came to the Murdoch family, the ones that we still associate with them. So he was helping Keith Murdoch do that. He was, when he was a young journalist, Keith Murdoch took a real interest in him, but later became Jack Williams became Keith Murdoch's nemesis, and they sort of butted up against each other towards the end of Keith Murdoch's life. Jack Williams became the major driving force behind the Herald and Weekly Times after Keith Murdoch died, and he really took it to another level. Keith had expanded the company to a certain extent around Australia, but Keith Williams really took it to another level, and it expanded enormously, and he made a lot of money for shareholders and was considered a very canny, smart operator.
One of the reasons you say you wrote the book was to try and explain how Rupert Murdoch, the most powerful press baron the world has ever seen, actually, could only have come from Australia. And the conditions, the post-war conditions that allowed these newspaper empires and these media empires to rise, especially the Murdochs, what was so different here, and why was it different from what happened overseas?
So some of the people that I've been mentioning, figures like Rupert Henderson and Jack Williams and Keith Murdoch as well, I mean, they were pretty incredible people to learn from, and they created an environment here where newspapers were very powerful, probably because we've got a sort of smaller concentrated population too. There was real power in owning a metropolitan newspaper.
Interesting. Was that it? Because that's right. Australia really is it's not a nation of towns and cities. It's a nation of cities, isn't it? We've got Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth, to some degree Hobart, and that's the nation in a sense, isn't it? We like to think about the bush, but of course, in terms of concentration of people, that's where everyone is, in these cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that means there might only be room for, say, two morning newspapers, or in outside of Sydney and Melbourne, one morning newspaper, which gives you a lot of power. Something like the Western Australian, for example, would reach an incredible proportion of the population when it's in its heyday. So these papers do have a lot of power because they're reaching a lot of people on a day-to-day basis. And these proprietors that we're talking about and their executives, they use that power, and they're very forceful in Australia. Maybe we play newspapers the way we play politics and sport, which is pretty forceful and aggressive.
Tell me about that. Why weren't their competitors rising? Or did they squash them? How did it happen?
Yeah, they definitely squashed them, yeah. And that's a big part of what the job of someone like Rupert Henderson and Jack Williams is, to keep competitors at bay, to squash them, buy them out, whatever it takes. And they do this over and over again until there's not many papers left. So there's that. I mean, there's that sort of dynamic around these families and these proprietors and executives, where it's a training ground for someone like Rupert Murdoch, who, clearly learnt this from a very early age. There's also... This means that you have a lot of policy influence. So these newspaper owners and executives are very much at the scene of all the important political events. So as I was saying before, they're there when the Liberal Party is created. They give the nod to something like that. On policy matters, they absolutely demand their say in these years that I'm talking about. And the policies that mattered to them were getting more assets, particularly in media. So they get radio licences in the 20s under Joe Lyon's government. In television, that became a very important area of expansion for them. So in the late 1940s, 1950s, they demand that their voices are heard, and they're heard to such an extent that the system's really designed around them. And our first 11 commercial television licences in the big metropolitan markets go to newspapers. Yeah. And nowhere else in the world did you see governments handing over television license to big newspaper groups in that way. It meant
in other words, concentrating the power of media in the hands of very few people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a city, you could own the biggest circulation newspaper, plus a radio station, plus a television station, I mean, plus magazines. I mean, how much more power could you possibly get over public affairs? And so that's the sort of environment that we had here that meant that media barons could really throw their weight around. And Rupert Murdoch saw this, learned it, and did it better than anyone, really. But these are the conditions that he sort of grew up in, and the people that he was around.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most people might think, oh, well, Fleet Street would be the toughest, street in town. You say that's not true. Australia was a lot tougher.
Yeah, well, someone who'd worked in both places that I talk about in the book, Colin Bednall, and he said Fleet Street was genteel by comparison with Australia, and especially Sydney.
Tell us about Rupert then. He starts off in, that's right, his father Keith dies in 1953. He'd learnt how to use power. He'd been close to it. All he's left with, though, is the Adelaide News. People do forget this, that he didn't start with, I mean, he just started with something, obviously, but not much. And he did build it from there. It's an extraordinary rise, isn't it? This listen to this. It's an excerpt from an ABC TV documentary series on prominent Australians that aired in July 1967. And a 36-year-old Murdoch responds to a question about whether or not he likes the feeling of power of being a newspaper proprietor with outlets in every state of Australia.
Well, there's only one honest answer to that, of course, and that's yes. Of course one enjoys the feeling of power. Although, if I can just hold you there for a minute, I think that this question of the power of newspaper proprietors can be greatly overdone. We have certain, but we have more responsibility than power, I think. The newspaper can create great controversies, stir up arguments within the community, discussion, can throw light on injustices, just as it can do the opposite. It can hide things and be a great power for evil.
It's not a perfect system, obviously, but can you think of a better one? I think the important thing is that there'd be plenty of newspapers with plenty of different people controlling them, so that there's a variety of viewpoint, that there's a choice for the public. This is the freedom of the press that is needed. Freedom of the press mustn't be one-sided just for a publisher to speak as he pleases. Try and bully the community. There must be an alternative. And so long as there are alternatives, then I think that the public's very well protected. Certainly better protected than they'd be if the whole thing was run by a government instrumentality.
This is Rupert Murdoch back in 1967. It goes on, though, with journalist Peter Nicol asking the hard question with a relatively honest answer from young Rupert Murdoch.
That is the question of power, of course. Who's really got it, the editor or the newspaper proprietor? Do you, for instance, interfere much with your editor's policies?
Yes, I do a bit. I get very involved in the newspapers themselves and in public arguments that we're conducting or involved in. But, on the other hand, I think that I give my editors tremendous freedom, and the only people who claim that I don't give them enough freedom now are the people who didn't know how to use it.
It's pretty creepy in a way. I mean, this is 1967. You really would think that nothing much has changed, would you?
Exactly. And I mean, we're talking about Rupert's start before. So yes, he had one newspaper, The News, and it was a fairly small newspaper, and it wasn't going too well. Keith Murdoch had been running it, but it wasn't going gangbusters.
No, not by any
so
means.
It had that, but it also had some small radio stations and magazine capacity. So it was more than one newspaper, that company that he inherited. But his biggest disappointment was that he didn't inherit the Queensland newspaper as well, the Courier Mail. So he felt robbed of that paper because it was sold off to pay for debts that his father had amassed in trying to build up this empire for Rupert. So Keith Murdoch knew he was sick, and he put all of his effort and money and attention towards trying to leave Rupert an empire that he could expand. And obviously Rupert did that in a way that I don't think he could have even imagined or dreamed that he ever would take it as far as he has. But that was his intention, because Keith Murdoch had been an executive tied to a company, and the company that he built up, the Herald and Weekly Times, he only had a small number of shares in that. He couldn't hand that on to Rupert. Rupert had to find his own way via this other path. So it was a small start, but if you're 21 or 22, inheriting a metropolitan newspaper and some radio stations and magazines is not a bad start.
That's true, but he did it, and others didn't.
That's true.
Whatever you make. What do you think his big break was?
Television. So, and that's where you separate out the newspapers that are going to survive from those that aren't, the ones that aren't going to do well. Mm. So television really separated them, and getting a television license in Adelaide, as Rupert Murdoch, he threw his full emphasis on that, and getting that was a big break for him, and he made the most of it, as he did with all the opportunities that he made come his way. So I think television was a big turning point. That's when you get commercial advertising on television. They were making lots of money because there was only a limited number of stations. It was a new medium. There were limited space for ads by government regulations. So it was you can name your price in some sense. So he did very well out of television, and he took that opportunity forward. But the other major thing that happened was that Rupert Henderson, that I mentioned before, sold to Rupert Murdoch a newspaper that the Fairfax family had, and that having a Sydney paper was also a big thing for Rupert Murdoch. It really took him to another level as well.
Mm. Yes. Another anniversary this year. It's 60 years since the Faceless Men photograph appeared in the Daily Telegraph in 1963, which led to a press campaign portraying Labor at the height of the Cold War era as being instructed by secretive types. This is something that, of course, Gough Whitlam had to fight against hugely. What was the real story here?
So Alan Reid, the journalist who worked for the Packer family for most of his career, at this time is working for Frank Packer, and Alan Reid is part of that company's campaign really against the Labor Party at this time. Packer was very anti-union, anti-Labor, anti-socialism, and anti-communism. He saw communists everywhere.
Mm.
So Alan Reid, working for Frank Packer, sees an opportunity when he sees Gough Whitlam and Arthur Calwell standing outside waiting to be told Labor policy from the Labor conference that night. They're standing out in the street under a street lamp, and he rustles up a photographer to take a photo of this. And, of course, it's a very powerful symbolism that Labor's leaders, who weren't included in the conference at that time, it had delegates from all the states, but they're standing outside waiting to hear what policy matters are being decided and how they can determine policy. So it becomes this very visual image of a party that's not even necessarily controlled by its leaders, it's controlled by these faceless men. That's the line that begins to be circulated, and it's a very powerful argument that Labor and Whitlam said that he thought it cost them at least two elections, if not more.
Mm. Yes, exactly. Exactly. It was a powerful argument too, and people were right to respond to it. This is Nightlife with me, Philip Clark. We're talking tonight with Sally Young, Professor of Political Science at the University of Melbourne, about her recent book, Media Monsters, The Transformation of Australia's Newspaper Empires. And we're talking about the newspaper period the media period between the 1940s and the 1970s. Why did governments not do what you might think is the obvious thing, Sally, and go for more diversity? I mean, they must have known by concentrating power in the hands of a few media people that they are creating a monster, a demon for themselves. Why did they not decide to go for more diversity, do you think?
Well, I think a few reasons. One is that sometimes those media barons are on your side, in which case limiting them is not a wise thing to do. And there is a fear. I mean, there's always been a fear.
You're talking about it's a long period of Menzies being in power. He thought the media. He had the media in his pocket, did he?
Well, that might be putting a bit strongly, but someone like Frank Packer was definitely on Menzies' side. He adored Menzies, and made no secret of that. And his papers were extremely pro Menzies and anti Labor. But the Conservative Sydney Morning Herald, the Herald and Weekly Times papers in Melbourne and elsewhere, Adelaide, Queensland, they're conservative. So there are a lot of conservative media owners that are backing Menzies for years. So upsetting them is not a wise thing to do. Under his reign, the television licenses go to them, so that expands their power. Then they're so big that they're very difficult to stand up to, even if you wanted to. And at the end of his tenure in office when Menzies knows he's getting towards retirement in the early 60s and mid-60s, around that period, he starts trying to limit their power, but it's a bit late. So they try to sort of restrict and have some restrictions on media ownership. And even in the original media policies, they have that. But the media companies just use their lawyers to find loopholes in all these different mechanisms that are tried. So that's one aspect of it as well, is that you know, they're sometimes difficult to stop. Sometimes you don't want to stop them. Sometimes it's politically unwise to try and stop them. But eventually media restrictions are brought in, and even then some companies like the Herald and Weekly Times just keep buying up assets. But later on they're policed a bit more carefully and their assets are sort of frozen. They can't buy any more television stations, for example. But they've got so many by that point that it's a bit redundant, really. Their power is quite enormous.
Mm. That's right. It's not until the 1990s that actually some serious efforts, I think, under the Hawke Keating government begins to try and limit them. But by then, as you say, the horse has pretty much bolted, hasn't it?
Mm. Yeah, so it's in the 1980s that they try and really separate them into sort of princes of print and queens of the screen and so on. But before that, they were owning multiple media at the same time and you know, restrictions on that were very limited. So that was unlike the situation in other countries, say even the US, for example, which has a very free market system. There they really tried to limit them and prevented them owning a television station in the same city, for example. But here they were, they grew very large, especially by the 60s. And they're not even just in media. They own all sorts of things, like print and records, book publishing, leisure companies, courier company, just a whole range of different businesses they owned by that point.
Mm. There were big barriers to entry in a way too, weren't there? You needed capital to start media empires these days. You had to buy printing presses and so on. There was a lot of money involved in setting it up. You needed backers. And this was a natural barrier, I suppose, to competition too. Once you got fairly big, a competitor really needed a lot of money to get into the ring with you, didn't they? Didn't stop Murdoch, of course, when he starts The Australian. How did that start?
Yeah, so he takes a very big leap because, as you say, there are very big barriers to starting up a newspaper. It was, the costs were enormous. So most of these companies we're talking about are from the 1800s. That's how much of, you know, having an early start and all of that capital and name is so important that newcomers find it very difficult to compete. So Ezra Norton started a new paper during the war years when there's a big audience, but that was a sort of different time and there were newsprint restrictions, so that prevents newcomers as well. But between that period and the early 1960s, when Rupert Murdoch starts up The Australian, and he's thinking about it in the early 1960s, it's really a brave move of him to do that because we are a big dispersed country, as we were saying before. So the idea of having a national newspaper, it had been dreamed about by his father, Keith Murdoch, and by others, including Rupert Henderson and Colin Bednall, that all dreamed of starting up a quality national newspaper in Australia. But everyone looked at the economics of that and thought, this isn't going to work. We haven't got enough of a elite sort of intellectual population who want a quality paper, like a British Guardian. We haven't got the population or numbers to make that profitable. And how do we do advertising across the country? And how do we report politics or sport when there's different codes and all sorts of variations and things? So he took a big leap in wanting to set up this national newspaper. And he was racing against Rupert Henderson from Fairfax Company, who was looking at doing the same, also out of Canberra. So he starts up The Australian and he puts a lot of money into it and a lot of his attention, you know, is in there rolling up the sleeves, telling them, you know, front pages and editorials, and is very hands-on proprietor, as he's always been. And he puts everything into this newspaper and he supports it over decades when it's not profitable. It doesn't make money for a long time, but he keeps it going. So it's obviously always been a very important project to him.
Still doesn't make money, you'd have to say. Just before we go, the other influential voice in Australian media, of course, has been us, the ABC. But these big proprietors also learned the art of undermining the national broadcaster, which they are still at to an extent, aren't they?
They never stopped. From the 1920s, when the ABC was, you know, a radio medium, that they're in radio, the newspaper owners as well, and they see it as a major competitor. And the ABC wasn't allowed to collect its own news. The newspaper proprietors had done a deal with Joe Lyons that said the ABC had to take its news from the newspapers and pay them for what they took. So this is how the ABC begins, actually in the shadow of newspaper proprietors, and politically controlled in this way. So it's not until the 1940s when the ABC is developing its own independent news services and gets out from under the thumb of the newspaper proprietors. So they tried to control it from the beginning and had some success with that. They even determined when the ABC could broadcast its news. So this was Keith Murdoch's idea. He wanted it after 7 p.m. because the Herald, the afternoon paper in Melbourne, is out on the streets in the afternoon and they don't want people rushing home to listen to the radio instead of buying the Herald. So they tell them when the ABC can broadcast its news, how they can collect it, and so on. So that's how it begins. When television comes in, obviously they're annoyed as well because any viewers who are watching the ABC aren't watching the commercial channels, so that's less ability to sell advertising to them. So they also undermine it when it begins. They say it's got a very small audience for television, that its programming's boring, that it's that it shouldn't be there, there shouldn't be any public broadcasting. And of course, when we get into later years and the ABC's getting into the internet, then the same arguments are coming up because the ABC's always undermining their business model. Mm. It's got a government secured government funding and they don't. So they've put a lot of effort into, over the years, always trying to needle the ABC and keep a very close eye on it and do all they can to undermine it.
Yep, I think it's the little excerpt of the interview we played with Murdoch earlier shows, and the book shows too, what is old is always new again. And the seeds of everything we see today and the, some might say, the affronts that we see today all had their seeds back then. It's a very interesting survey. Sally Young, it's been terrific to talk, and we look forward to some more volumes.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.